Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Welcome back to the tailgate podcast. I am Terry Foy. He is Nick Osello. And once again, for the first time in more than 2 months, we are recording as Notre Dame plays a game. Nick, how are you doing, buddy?
Good. I just had a little bit of a panic because my ESPN account stopped working. I'm currently in Los Angeles at my good friend Cooper Perkins. That's Cooper Perkins PXP on all social media. He went to call a water polo game. I'm heading to the airport in like an hour and a half, 2 hours. Liam Eneman's just so good, Terry. He's just good at stopping the ball, which you love to see out of a goalie. So not only shout out to Cooper for letting me record solo in his apartment, but he provided me a microphone. So if I come off as clear and great and
professional,
my voice is just awesome in your ears. Shout out to Cooper. Hit it a little too hard yesterday. Not feeling great right now. But if there's a place to overserve yourself, Los Angeles is probably a top four spot to do it. What an area.
So on February 25th, we watched as the Georgetown Hoyas handed the Notre Dame Fighting Irish, your alma mater, and the defending national champions their first and to this point only loss of the season in overtime. And it turns out our listeners really enjoy your real-time pain. They asked that we continue to record as frequently as possible when the Irish are playing, and we haven't been able to do it until now. You are currently listening to us as the Irish lead Duke 9-6 with about 5 minutes left in the third quarter. And as you mentioned, Liam Entenmann has been really good so far in this game. He's got 9 saves. His counterpart, Patrick Jameson, has 7 saves and 9 goals allowed. The story definitely has been Pat Kavanaugh. He's got 4 goals and an assist. In the first, 25, 30 minutes of the game, it was really about Brandon O'Neill's quietness. He now has 1 goal on 6 shots. Dyson Williams has 2 to lead the Blue Devil offense. Nick, what are you seeing from this game, at least the parts of it that you were able to see as your ESPN account intermittently became available to you?
Yeah, no, it's interesting because as I watched Duke's defense, play against Notre Dame, I did make a call to the police because the attempted manslaughter on Pat Kavanaugh is quite frankly disgusting. And I try not to dog on college kids because I'm like, listen, I've been in these realms. I certainly, played with a little too emotion. But if Brower cheap shots Pat Kavanaugh one more time again, I'm going to dox him. I'm going to talk about a lot of things, none of which I'm going to follow through on. But that chippiness aspect, love to see that. Liam Eneman, I still,
fifth-year hips.
Oh my God, he's so good at stopping the ball. And just for the record, Terry is about 20 seconds ahead of me on the stream. So Eneman just made a ridiculous bounce shot save. Looks like it's his 10th of the day, and now a diving crease. And I hate that every time.
Don't love this push call on Nick Harris right here.
No, and that's the problem is, you might have called out that Tierney was the first person to do this, but, if you're just running towards the crease, it's going to result in a penalty 9 times out of 10. So, late in a possession or at any point, just roll underneath, pretend to be hit, don't pretend to be hit, dive. You're just going to get a push call. I'm watching the replay right now, and it's
he extended his arms. That was the problem.
But it didn't impact... I don't know.
Correct.
I always want penalties based on the impact of what happened on the game. That didn't impact Duke at all. There was also a semi-viral clip. I had a great amount of nostalgia of Kevin Corrigan just absolutely ripping into, I can't remember who it was. And I'm like, yeah, your life sucks right now. You're going to miss getting lit up on the sidelines in a couple short years. Great. That was O'Neal who just shot it infinity miles an hour off the crossbar. But overall, love what I'm seeing from Notre Dame. It's interesting because one of the games that we're going to talk about is which game am I going to be referencing? I think it was Hopkins Penn State it was the Yale game where Penn. Damn it, Duke just scored. I don't like doing these because every time my train of thought gets imploded at the station, as Duke Dyson Williams just made it a two-goal game. But the thing that concerns me about Notre Dame, and we've kind of alluded or hinted at it in the past, is just like the Yale-Penn game, Penn's defense objectively played bad, but they have a quality goalie. So I think that you can kind of trick yourself into thinking that your defense is better than they are. I'm always a defensive, first-minded type of person. I'm not impressed with Notre Dame's defense. I'm impressed with Liam Enemann bailing them out. And I think that that's an important distinction to make and something that they really need to clear up and clean up if they're going to repeat this year. What are you seeing, Terry?
Well, so before the game, I tweeted that there were two things that I wanted to see. The first was Duke had played, I think it was 6 games in 18 days leading into last Wednesday. We talked about it, I think, on last week's podcast. And now they're coming off of a 9 or 10 day layoff. One of the elements of this program that was kind of like a hallmark when they were, you know, going to national championship games and winning in 2010, 13, and 14 was how much better they got around spring break. And some of the folks that whose opinions I really trust when it comes to the game really isolated how it seemed as if the shooting, the quality and precision of their shots just went to another level from the standpoint of their stick work. This was not spring break, this 10-day layoff. But at the same time, I was curious as to whether or not it was going to have a similar effect in terms of rest and re-engagement. I thought that, you know, in the Denver and BU games, it felt like a Blue Devil team that was just trying, and really kind of the Syracuse game a week prior, it felt like they were just trying to get to the end, right? They could see the light at the end of the tunnel, and they were just trying to get to the end of the stretch. Uh-oh. We might see Nick Cosello on the screen here in the next 25 seconds. But that being said, with respect to what I wanted to see, you know, are they re-engaged? Are they reinvigorated? And I think to this point, I would say
no. Oh, no. Oh, God. They're doing the national championship. Oh, God, turn it off. Make it stop. There's Marty Collins defending Jordan Wolf. No chance. Yeah, have a good one, fellas. Losers. Anyways,
I mean, literally winners. Point. They just showed the 2014 national champions on the field at halftime celebrating.
I could beat the
shit
out of all of those guys at the same time. Miles, your first. Deemer, your second. Just clean sweep. If Pete doesn't get you, repeat will get you. And I'd take every one of them in a one-on-one fight. Try me. Anyways, what were we talking about?
So, yeah, it was just I haven't seen a Duke team that came out with their hair on fire and felt like they had benefited from recharging the batteries over the course of the last 10 days. That being said, you know, we'll see how that's the type of thing that could manifest in the last 20 minutes if they figure out a way to kind of dig deeper into the well and out energy Notre Dame down the stretch. The other thing I was looking for hasn't come to fruition at all, which is I'm very surprised that Notre Dame hasn't decided to guard Brendan O'Neill with Sean Light, a freshman, you know, against one of the best players in the country, no doubt about it. But at the same time, it's a physical matchup that has proven to be one of the ways to take Brennan out of the game. He's been guarded so far. They started with Chris Conlon on him. I know Marco Napolitano, who's more of an interior guy, got switched onto him. So, you know, a lot in terms of how Notre Dame has approached this overall 6-on-6 defensive matchup, Light has predominantly been on Josh Sawada. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was the other thing I was looking at. And so the fact that it hasn't even been kind of an available outcome puts me a little bit back on my heels relative to how to analyze this game. But I think that, you know, to your point about Kenny Brower, certainly early in the elements was they used Pat Kavanaugh at the top of the box to try to attack more downhill. And that got a lot of success. Right now we're watching as Kavanaugh is operating at X, gets Brower hung up and converts, which you will see here in about 10 seconds.
Nice. So Kavanaugh hung up at X. Wonder what's going to happen here. Stupid idiot goalie goes out to play him. Does absolutely. Oh, God. What are you doing, Duke? That's just such bad defense. How stupid could you be? God, if you're a goalie. So this was my favorite aspect of Coach Burns' defense, because in this situation, regardless, you'd never want to be hung up for more time than you need to. So it was understood on Notre Dame's defense that as soon as you're hung up, you drive and flush out the attackman to wherever the ball came from. And so everybody was on the same page, and you didn't have stupid moments like this. And I always considered the difference between like Duke early in the season when we'd kill them versus in the playoffs when we're like, okay, let's hope somebody knocks them out before we lose to them by one or two. A lot of it came down to the comfortability that they have on with offensive pressure, because a lot of what we did on defense kind of dictated having the stick on their hands affecting the quality of their passes. Greatly impacted and worked. And you could say this of most teams, but I feel like that was always a huge difference. You know, even in that flashback, a guy like Jordan Wolfe, I think, does it perfect, where earlier in the year he would dodge, he would get ready to re-dodge and kind of like maybe pass it or just do something. But like the re-dodge, the comfortability with pressure where they could hit those skip passes, the quality of those skip passes, I'm actually really interested to see how that works for Duke, because it's usually about this time of the year that we really see the difference in their first games and what they're going to be doing in the playoffs. And also, just a funny side note, as I've mentioned a couple times on the podcast, Jamie Iketa is my best friend. He was number 13 at Duke. And the year that Notre Dame and Duke both missed the playoffs, we were not confident. We always make like, you know, hey, we have to pay dinner or lunch by the end of the year. Based on the outcome of this game. And that year we flipped, and I actually bet that Duke would win and he bet that Notre Dame would win. And we thought it was so funny that we were rooting against our alumni that we've made that an annual bet. So I'm pulling for Duke on the sandwich front and I'm pulling for Notre Dame on every other front. And I told my dad this and he got legitimately upset at it. He was like, what are you guys doing betting against your own teams? And I'm like, I don't know. It's kind of funny, Dad. What's the problem? So just a little bit of a layer here. I think it'll make me provide better analysis because there is a sandwich incentive associated with Duke. We have 30 seconds left. Duke is clearing, which means it's about 10 seconds left for Terry. So we'll go into the live action here. One of the things that I think is a great barometer for if a program is good or not is how rushed they are at 30, 20, 15, 10, 5 seconds. So Duke's initiating with 20 seconds left. Good teams understand that 20 seconds is a world of time, as we see O'Neal run past the top center, dodge, just slide early on that, pass to the backside shot. Yeah, right, you're going to score that on Liam Enemann. What an idiot. So very interesting right there. I don't know who was isolated top center for Duke, but that's an example right there. You have 3 seconds left on the shot clock. You have a Duke attackman with a low angle lefty shot. And you have a midi with an isolated short stick top center. Like if I'm the defensive coordinator, I'm saying, hey, it doesn't matter. Slide early to that top center dodge. Take that away, because you, with Enemann in cage, you should be comfortable giving up that low angle shot as opposed to a shot from top center. So that's kind of like an example as we close out the second quarter.
Third quarter.
Or third quarter, sorry. That's an example of something that I'm like, you know, it's a little thing, but when you're playing and that's Schellenberger top center or whoever else, and, you know, it's Virginia in the quarterfinals, that could be the game losing, you know, defensive or lack of defensive slide that Enemann might may or may not bail out.
Yeah. All right, Nick, let's take advantage of the
Free talk games.
Yes, let's do it, because you're not going to be distracted by what's happening with the bizarre senior citizen pedal underneath your desk contraption commercial on TV.
I'm seeing a Ryan Gosling commercial. So
that is distracting.
Distracted. What a smoke. Okay, so Big Ten. It's Big Ten season. It's chaotic. Hopkins wins 9-8 in overtime. Happy Valley, more like Sad Valley. I'm going to say that every time Penn State loses. I also have this bit running about how this is Andrew's brother, Penn's Tate. Okay, so if you like defense and low-scoring goals, this was the game for you. 2 goals in the first 26 minutes, and it was an absolute snooze fest. Penn State led 4-2 at half, but this also makes a lot of sense because Penn State had 2 key returners making their season debut, and one of the defensemen only played against Colgate, got injured in Colgate, and made the return as well. So if you see Hopkins scoring 9 goals and you think that's a good defensive performance by Penn State, that makes a lot of sense. So the OT winner came from Matt Collison off of a very, very standard play. Just a sweep to the middle of the field, pass to the cage. The second slide was late, and really, really bad defense that allowed that to ultimately be probably the easiest OT winner that we'll see this season. Degnan had a hat trick for Hopkins. Kostin and TJ Malone had hat tricks for Penn State. And, you know, the Big Ten's going about as the Big Ten should, which is, you know, kind of absolute chaos. But Hopkins sneaks one over Penn State.
Yeah, so I covered this game. To be clear, it was at Homewood Field, not Happy Valley or Sad Valley, whichever you prefer.
But yeah, Happy Valley, Sad Valley, I'm going to say that no matter what.
Jack Posey is the defender who made his season debut after tearing his ACL in the quarterfinal win over Army last year. And Kevin Parnum is the defender who was injured against Colgate and made his return after missing, I guess it would be 8 games or 7 games. And yeah, I mean, these two teams were averaging a combined 27 goals per game coming in. So 10 goals short of their season average. And through, I guess, 27 minutes, they were on pace to score about 2.3 goals in the entire game. It definitely opened up in the end of the second quarter. And I think if you're Hopkins, you can come away with a lot of positives. The first was, In the early part of the game, they felt like they were getting robbed by Jack Frassian. And I thought he played really well, but I actually thought that Hopkins' offense was settling for shots that were 2, 3, 4 yards beyond the range that they should have been willing to take. There was one Russell Melendez play, I think, on either the first or second possession that was an example of, you know, him settling for a shot from, let's call it, 14 or 15 yards when he probably had a yard or two in front of him that he could have stepped into and made the shot a little bit easier as he was kind of facing the full 36 square feet. So with that being said, one of the things that Hopkins staff and you know, to some extent, at least their players didn't even realize throughout the game was how well Chase Erland was playing. And I think one of the reasons is because he was making a lot of saves with his body and specifically with his chest where Frassian was pulling the ball out of the air, and they ended up finishing with 16 saves apiece. And that was definitely a part of it. But the other element of the first half, and it persisted throughout the entirety of the game, but it was really pronounced in the first quarter. Let's just call it the first 20 minutes of the game, where I think there were a total of 8 deflected passes that stayed in bounds and turned into cause turnovers. And I think Hopkins had 6 of them. And there were a bunch of deflected shots as well. So it was just one of those games where it felt like sticks were in the passing lanes all the time. And it wasn't as if these offenses were really forcing it. It was much more so that the defenses were playing really well. And, you know, Bowden Zulik, he has turned into a production monster. I think he finished with 3 cause turnovers and 3 ground balls, and he was just excellent. And Scott Smith, you know, one of the best defensemen, spent a lot of time guarding TJ Malone. And yeah, it was just a really good defensive performance. And I think to your point about Big Ten play and it being Big Ten play and you know, that having a particular identity, it's the defensive matchups against each other, how familiar they are with each other, the way in which both staffs, and not just in this particular matchup, but in many of the matchups, are willing to and kind of prefer to run a lot of shot clock because they don't think that you can diagnose these defenses quickly and because they don't want to settle for bad shots. And we talked about how I felt like Hopkins was settling for shots from range that were too far out. But I think that at least they were satisfied that they were shots coming in the last 30 seconds of the shot clock, not in the first 30 seconds of the shot clock. And so, you know, as the game started to pick up again, both at the end of the second quarter and then, you know, throughout the second half, I felt like, you know, it was playmaking is kind of what it came down to. Didn't feel like there were obvious tactical changes or, you know, significant things that had happened that kind of changed the tenor of the game. You mentioned Garrett Degnan finishing with 3 goals. He, you know, got a lot of space off ball, and I thought did a nice job of capitalizing on those opportunities. But at the same time, you know, it wasn't as if there was a particular matchup like Jacob Angeles going at the same defender or Russell Melendez really getting a step that kind of separated things. It was a combination of playmaking and taking advantage of opportunities as they present themselves. Nick, can we get a Notre Dame Duke update?
Mm-hmm. So literally right as you said that, Notre Dame scored, and now it's an 11-8 game. But I got to say, with my critical eye, I'm really not impressed with Notre Dame's defense, because Duke's pole scored, and it was on two bad approaches, a missed first chance ground ball, and then Duke got an additional good look because a short stick middie chased Duke's midfielder almost to the midway line on like a loose ball that Duke was quite clearly going to get. In those situations, yes, you want to lock off the wing attackman because they just made an easy pass to the wing. He had a full head of steam, no slide, shot from top center. What is interesting, though, is prior to that possession, if Eric Dobson can mix this into his game, he goes from great to lethal player. Had a full head of steam going down the lefty alley and very easily just threw back to the top center, keeping it in his left hand. Which is something that I haven't seen him do consistently, as we see a big old scrum. Uh-oh. There's Mandy Merritt, the trainer. We have Pat Cavanaugh, as Coach Corrigan is asking the ref how his wife and kids are doing.
This one's going to be a
Oh, there's
storyline.
the flag from Corrigan. Yes. Yeah. Get him, coach.
I think this one's going to be on
Corrigan's
Chris
yelling at
Kavanaugh.
Chris, who's concerned about his brother Pat. This is April lacrosse. Pissed off. Hopefully, it looks like Pat Kavanaugh's shoulder may have come out of its socket. Mandy Merritt, the athletic trainer, she's awesome. As Pat goes down to sit down and get attended to, let's see what happened on the replay here.
Is this a total sell job?
Oh my God, it might be.
Don't know. It wasn't clear whether he was grabbing his left elbow or right shoulder more.
Yeah. He's kind of like bear hugging himself. And then Chris Kavanaugh did something that really pissed off Corrigan.
And resulted
Oh
in
God, I love it.
a 1 minute extra man.
1 minute extra man because the ref got his feeling hurt. Corrigan's walking to midfield. Chris Kavanaugh got the unsportsmanlike. Boy, enjoy practice tomorrow morning, fellas. That one's going to be a tough one. So this is just beautiful. Corrigan's mad at the refs. Chris Kavanaugh gets an unsportsmanlike. Pat Kavanaugh, we don't know if he hurt his shoulder or his elbow or if he's doing a sell job. And I will say, with the departure of Bill Tierney, we can rely on one man and one man only for me to get stressed about the health of the coach. Like, Corrigan should be wearing a whoop at all times and just being like, okay, here's your stats from the game. Hey, everything okay, coach? Like, just, don't hurt yourself. As Duke has good ball movement, skip to the top center, pass to the top right. And shot, potential goal. God, this is a chaotic game. Notre Dame's man down isn't looking great, or Duke's man up is just that good. Terry, which one do you think it is?
I think that you're going to really enjoy the way that this possession ends, and I am enjoying being 20 seconds ahead of you the whole time. That being
Well,
said,
now I have to.
we.
Yeah, well, you're like, I think you're going to enjoy it. Now I'm like, well, now I can't say anything because now I'm getting ready to watch. Something happened as there was like a timeout. Injury happened behind the play. Liam Eneman, who just got up, he's
Well,
fine.
the what I was referring to is an incredible save that he made. But also he got tripped behind the play on a on the clearing play and looked like he was a little worse for the wear, but gave the thumbs up to the sideline. And or do we have a new goalie in this game? Was Alex Zepf coming in? Storylines upon storylines in this one. Nick, we got a stoppage in play, so let's take the opportunity to move on to the next one.
Okay. You did a great job segueing this because the two returning Penn State defensive players, one tore his ACL against Army, the other got hurt against Colgate.
Yeah.
Oh, speaking of Colgate Army, Terry, in my great analysis, I was doing a thorough deep dive into the rosters. Colgate has a player from Idaho, Army does not. And for that reason and that reason alone, shout out Wiley Warkal. Colgate 14, Army 11 in a massive Patriot League upset. We talk about Big Ten chaos. The Patriot League is just, take a nice bowl of pasta salad, throw it against the wall, and that's kind of what the Patriot League is. So coming out of a loss from Navy, it's pretty clear that Colgate can beat or lose to anybody on any given day. They are a dangerous team. And what was interesting, it was Colgate's 10-man that really kind of stole the show. Because if you're just looking at it from a stats perspective, Army beat them in almost every other relevant statistic. Face-off, shots on nets, ground ball, you know, the list goes on. But using that kind of 10-man ride chaos, they went on a 6-goal run in the third. And ultimately, that made the score 14-8 and insurmountable. Another thing that I liked was 7 different goal scorers for Colgate. Hunter Druin had 4 leading the day. Jackson Eicher had 4 for Army, but they, quite frankly, struggled offensively. And Terry, are you an advocate of increasing the military budget so that Army can address this this lapse in consistency that we've seen from them over the last couple weeks?
It's actually kind of funny. Did you know that you probably did because you coached at Air Force and probably coached at Air Force during a government shutdown and as a result weren't able to practice or travel, but Army and Navy are, because they actually fall outside of the infrastructure. They have the athletic departments are their own kind of whatever, non-for-profit organizations. With that being said, whatever it takes to kind of get the clearing sorted out. But what I also think is interesting is how the 10-man doesn't necessarily always manifest only in failed clears. We've talked about it when we've talked about it earlier in this season with respect to how it can take you out of your flow offensively, because you can sometimes, you know, if it takes you, say, 17 seconds to get across the midline and then you have to sub, sometimes you then find yourself in a position where your offense only has 40 or 45 seconds to run their looks. And if you're an offense that really relies on or takes advantage of, you know, say a 55 or 60 second possession, then that can be one of the ways in which it manifests. And then also, you know, if you get a couple back, right, in terms of certainly if you score off of a ride back, but also if you just if you're a little bit more efficient in your offensive possessions after those failed clears, then even if the opponent's clear percentage is still high, doesn't mean that you're not benefiting from it. And the reason I bring it up is because Army cleared the ball 21 out of 24 times. So 3 failed clears, like that is a good day, right? They were over 85%. Meanwhile, Colgate failed 8 clears. They cleared 27 to 35, and it manifested in the turnover numbers as well. They turned the ball over 30 times to Army's 24. So you're right. That was a substantial aspect of how this unfolded. But the other substantial aspect was saves. Colgate made 18 saves. Army made 6. And in a 3-goal game, it can be pretty difficult to overcome that spread, that difference in terms of the way in which the game unfolds. We've already seen Army make changes in their, you know, goalie situation, inserting Sean Byrne into the starting lineup. But Matt Lacombe has played really well all season. And so, you know, for his 18 save, 11 goal allowed day, again, hard not to look at it and say that was a huge factor in terms of the outcome.
And where we're at in Notre Dame game, there was a shot from top center that bounced off the pipe. Did it bounce off the pipe, cross the goal line and go out? The refs just spent 55 years of my life deciding, no, it didn't, and we can finally get back to some action.
That being said, I definitely think it did. Like,
it looked pretty clear that it did.
Yeah.
And refs are now calling pushes. I mean, is the fix in? I mean, at this point.
I mean, you're up playing 3 with 11 minutes field to go. Hey, by the way, this game was sold out. We should talk about how awesome the crowds were all over the country. The game I was at had 5,600, something like that. They had more than 5,000 at UVA Carolina, which we're going to get to. They had more than 4,000 at Maryland Ohio State, which we're going to briefly get to at the end of this as well. But yeah, Colgate Army.
And the Vancouver Warriors had like 13,000 fans at their game, I think, as they're on a 4-goal run as we go into a little NLL. San Diego's crowd was good as well. So
Maryland women sold out at home against Northwestern.
Maryland women sold out. I mean, you can't get past anybody without them talking about Caitlin Clark. Oh God, that's what Brendan O'Neill does. And that's this whole talk about like, oh, is he a Towarton? Is he this? Is he that? He's been playing bad. Like his ability to just score when you think you're playing good defense separates himself from, I would say, all other, all other players. Like, there is not a player where after he scores, as we see a replay right here, you know, he's a lefty. You got to take away that sweep, and he just puts his shoulder down and gets a low angle shot.
Well, he switched onto a shorty. Now, granted, I think he's the best shorty in the country, and the slide was like a step late. But yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that that's a goal that you're willing to give up, but what's the alternative? Send that slide really, really early and see if he can feed the middle?
Yeah. But almost going back to that point, it was like he didn't really have his man beat as Notre Dame wins a faceoff forward. Let's see how we're doing here. Foul shot. Oh, goes just wide. But like, what Brendan O'Neill does a really good job of as well is just using his size to like not even create separation from his defensemen. And the guys that can get shots off and score without creating separation are the most dangerous guys on the field every single time. Because yes, that slide was objectively a step late and it resulted in a goal. But it's like, I didn't know that I was really supposed to slide because the short stick was in objectively decent position. And so, you know, oh God, I love that shot. It's not a high percentage shot, but that low angle, low to high. And why I love it is when it misses, it still looks cool. And those low angle, low to highs are the most dangerous because there could be somebody walking back there. And that element of danger is always fun as well.
I've got a take on Chris Kavanaugh. I think he is the most tailor-made American for sixes in terms of he will be in his prime in the 2028 Olympics. If I were able to pick one player to assuredly be on the U.S. Olympic team, it would be Chris Kavanaugh right now. And the reason I say that is because mid-range shooting is, to me, far and away the most important aspect. And his ability to get his own and hammer those mid-range shots is just a very valuable skill. Duke.
One goal game.
In transition.
One goal game alert.
Really nice top-down look. Oh, is that Dyson Williams sneaking from the backside pipe completely uncovered? Yes, that's exactly what happened. And with 9 minutes to go in the fourth quarter, Notre Dame leads the Blue Devils 11-10.
Well, and this one's just, oh, God, you don't take that's
a lot of sliding upfield.
That's really bad.
A lot of sliding upfield. This was what you were talking about
two
possessions ago. A lot of
sliding upfield, but getting your, matchup set, like, you can slide upfield if the guy running on the field knows that he's going low. So like anytime that like I was coming back in transition or something like that, the example that I'll use is like when Trevor Baptiste would just beat me forward like every single draw as we see another transition opportunity. Oh my God. Oh yeah, get excited. Shut up, dork, dumb.
Andrew McAdory with a really nice catch, one-handed, off the wing of the face-off. Comes down in transition, splits to his left, rolls back to his right, and yep. Will Donovan
bottom
just
right. And boy, is he an excited little boy. But this is also what makes Duke dangerous, is like you have McAdory on the wing, and that was not even an unsettled extra man opportunity. He was just like, hey, I have a head of steam. I'm going to get this off. Notre Dame recognized that they had to slide early. And he still, with that roll dodge, was able to get a pretty ridiculous shot off. Like that, the level of difficulty on that goal was crazy. And now it's 11-11. And if Notre Dame loses this game, and these are the only two times that I'm watching, then I'm not watching again. Duke wins it back. And oh, night. I'll have a little nap on the grass. Bop. And no call. About time the refs let the boys. Oh, there was a flag.
Yeah, it's coming. Jake Taylor with an absolutely enormous shoulder right to Jake.
That's
Maso.
That Colorado grit, baby.
That
come across the tracks on a Colorado player, you wind up in the dirt, boy.
That is,
make this a third.
Not necessarily a good call. That's shoulder to chest. I am usually a protect the players, hits to the head. Whatever. I mean, this is probably going to be called a defenseless, and that's why it's an illegal body check. But
that was more like a hard pick than it was like a shot to the head.
It looked so much worse in real time than it does on replay.
Yeah.
Once again, Duke goes man up with an opportunity to take the lead.
Ref show in frickin' Durham. He doesn't finish high. He doesn't initiate contact up high. The Duke faceoff guy was kind of like going up for a ball, and so his momentum kind of took him a little bit higher. And so when he landed on his back was the first thing to make contact after the hit. Yeah, it looks bad, ref. It doesn't mean it's a cheap shot or a one-minute penalty. Grow up. And Brendan O'Neill, I was going to bet my life savings, which is about $8, that was going to be a goal. But
worth noting that at this point, Notre Dame has won 15 to 26 faceoffs. It doesn't feel like that, having watched it. But they've done a really nice job. I think it's that Naso has gotten hot late.
All right, and Duke's on the man up now. After this next shot, we're going to talk about the next game. Nice soak. Or any other thoughts on Colgate Army?
Just that the Patriot League is wide open, and we're not going to talk about Loyola Bucknell, so let me just say two things about that game. First, Loyola jumped out to a 5-1 lead. Pretty sure Bucknell reeled off 10 straight. Loyola led 14-12 going into the last 2 minutes of the game. Bucknell scored in transition to make it 14-13 and then appeared to score immediately off the faceoff to tie it at 14. The goal got waved off. Loyola ended up icing it and won 15-13 for Charlie Toomey's career record-setting victory. But it's just an example of the fact that Bucknell, I think, is pretty clearly outside of the top six Patriot League team. And they took a Greyhound squad that was coming off of a big win over Lehigh to the absolute limit. And here we are, you know, like in terms of who the top six teams in this league are and how the tournament is going to unfold is a wide open question mark. But Army, after, you know, running the table out of conference, now finds themselves in a very precarious position with the losses that it's sustained in the league.
And question out of genuine curiosity, playoffs start today. Where's Colgate? I mean, two big wins over Penn State and Army, you know, quality wins versus bad losses. What's Colgate looking like?
So they don't really have an at-large resume. Their RPI is 21, which kind of puts them on the borderline of, would you look at them? Because they could potentially play themselves into having a resume. I think that the all-time low for RPI to have qualified for the 16-team field is 18, and that was in like 2008 or 9. Over the last 10 years, the typical low is 12 for the last at-large resume. And so they're pretty far outside of contention. Not only that, but also that Penn State win, though it's good on paper, is not a top-5 win, which tends to be, you know, one of those trump card deals. Navy, actually, with an RPI of 25, but having that win over Johns Hopkins, they have a top-5 win. So you can make an argument that the midshipmen actually have a higher quality NCAA tournament at-large resume than anybody else in the Patriot League.
Somebody, it might've been Dom's dad. He was like, yeah, Colgate, do you think they could make the playoffs? And I was like, I don't know. I'm going to ask Terry and then repeat verbatim what you just said and pawn it off as my own idea. And also, by the way, I love Eric Dobson's game. The only criticism I have of Eric Dobson is the same criticism that I had of myself. Is like, hey, full head of steam, you're going to get by your guy, but you're going to get trail checked relatively consistently. If he can clean that up, we've seen his throwback. We've seen he just scored, by the way, a couple seconds ago. Catch, face dodge, bury, bottom corner. So the fact that he's becoming a threat all over the field, which we already know that he is, we know the type of outside threat he is. So his game, the way that he's refining it, could pay off some nice dividends. Moving on, we'll stay in the ACC. And this one was, I mean, we haven't covered a bloodbath on this podcast yet, but this will be the marquee one that we do. UVA 14, Carolina 6. I mean, Terry, there's really not a lot to say about this game aside from utter domination. What does that look like? They jumped out to a 5-1 lead. UNC showed some signs of life with back-to-back goals, but was, you know, quite frankly, flatlined the rest of the game. You know, UNC was a dog, and Virginia brought chocolate to the game. That's really all there is to say about it. The good talking points, everything that Virginia did was better. Schellenberger had 5 points, 2 goals and 3 assists. Millen had 4, 2 and 2. Once again, UVA is good. Rumors that Bresch is on the hot seat. That's been enough of a stupid take on Twitter that I at least wanted to bring it up. But UVA, Carolina, Bresch, what do you got?
So he signed a 3-year extension after last season, meaning that this is the first of a 3-year extension. Now, with that being said, I don't know how it was structured relative to some of the potential outs after year one or year two. My question for you is, they changed their coaching staff tremendously, bringing in John Thompson as offensive coordinator and Dave Petromala as defensive coordinator. They're old, but they also have a lot of young contributors. On this podcast, a couple times over the course of this season, I have compared them to what I thought Syracuse was last year. My question for you is, with the same head coach in place, how okay is it for this to be a quote-unquote rebuilding year?
I mean, for a program like UNC, there shouldn't really be, like, distinguished rebuilding years in which you stink. Like, when Syracuse had that rebuilding year, they were playing good teams close. They were maybe dropping a bad game here and there, but they were a threat every single time that they stepped on the field. And that's what I'm not seeing. And that's kind of the big head scratcher for me is, like, even if you're rebuilding with coaching staffs, with young team, with, you know, whatever excuse that you want to make, you should be able to, you know, not be blown out, and you should be able to consistently compete. And I was explaining this the other day, but, you know, as it relates to rosters and young players and old players and this and that, really one of the things that you end up doing more than, you end up doing over the course of your college career that you're not even realizing is you're just kind of putting together pieces of what works, and that's how you're growing as a lacrosse player. So I learned the burn method defense, and I learned in that, oh, well, here's how you should play one-on-one if the slide package is this. What an easy dip and dunk. Jake Taylor, leave him wide open. Jake Taylor kills a guy and then scores a goal. That's the Colorado difference. But without even doing it, like, you're learning a system, and you get comfortable with that system. But alongside that, like, growing into a system, you learn pick plays. You learn how to communicate. You learn a lot of these fundamental where, hey, if we switch up everything next year, I still know how this should succeed, and I still know the fundamentals of communication, of sliding, of recovering, of this and that. So, no, I don't give them the slack because they're not being competitive, and there's no excuse for not being competitive when you have every advantage, the ACC, the blue blood, the pretty uniforms, you know, the quality education. They have every advantage. It's inexcusable that they're not competing.
So they're 6-5. Their RPI is 28. Their best win is over Penn. And I look at that with a little bit of extenuating circumstances because while they were coming off of a loss to Princeton at home, Penn was coming off of a win over Duke. Both games were 2 days prior. The psychological advantage was so clearly with the Tar Heels in the sense that, you know, Penn's best case scenario probably going down on that trip in terms of like their internal expectations among that roster was like, hey, if we get a split, that's a win. So to get a win over Duke on Friday and then have to turn around and play Carolina on Sunday, it's just hard to get as up as the team who's coming off of a home loss to Princeton would have been. Conversely, their worst loss very clearly is High Point. The thing that I struggle with is their schedule had a lot of teams that are ranked below 40 in the RPI, and they have beaten all of them. And then a lot of teams that are ranked like above 15. And so far they have beaten one of them, or depending on where Penn falls, they have yet to beat one. And that's what their rest of their season is going to look like with three ACC opponents remaining. The point is that they didn't play enough teams kind of like in that level, like in that 15 to 35 range where you really felt like you had a sense for exactly how good they were in the tier that they occupy. Now, of course, that's not the tier that they aspire to. And again, from the standpoint of like, is it reasonable to hold them to that standard? The question is, yeah, I think so. One of the other challenges when it comes to evaluating this team is a lot of times teams are artificially, you know, their level is bumped up or dragged down on the basis of their faceoff performance. They've got one of the best faceoff guys in the country in Brady Wambach. I mean, he's so good that they had another really good faceoff guy in Andrew Tyre. They moved him to the wing. Like, you took faceoffs and took the wing of faceoffs. You might be like the last guy that actually did that. Meanwhile,
Courier.
Sure.
Mean Courier.
Is he younger than
Holding
you?
It down.
Yeah, I guess he's a little younger than you.
No, we're the same age, but he's still playing in better.
Yeah. So point being that, like, that's not even a consideration. That's not an excuse. That's not something that you can point to if you're a Carolina fan and say, like, all right, well, once we figure out the faceoff situation, then we're going to be all good. It's not a good situation. And to me, the way out isn't clear in terms of what's going to come next.
Got it. So 3 minutes, 43 seconds left. We'll do a live kind of end game. So we'll just briefly and quickly talk about Yale Penn. And the story of the year, holy shit, Penn played a game that wasn't a one-goal game. Shocked everybody. They had a good first half. They were leading 5-4 midway through the second quarter, but this was the game that I referenced earlier where it was like, yeah, they were leading 5-4, but honestly, their defense was just porous. It was Swiss cheese, and they had to rely on a very good goaltender in Emmett Carroll to make pretty consistent and ridiculous saves. You can only ask of that so long, because in the second half and even the end of the second quarter, Yale, and more specifically Matt Brandel, just got those shots to fall. They were, you know, Carroll was making good saves. You can ask that so long. Second half, you know, he let in shots that probably should have been going in the first half anyways. So they kind of used the first half momentum of getting quality looks to ultimately make this a 12-9 game. Brandel makes everyone around him better, which I think makes him one of the best players in the country. He had 3 goals and 2 assists, but did much, much more than that. Liam Enemann is good at stopping the ball.
So I had this was out of the corner of my eye and throughout the game. And it felt like every time I was paying attention and Penn was struggling, it was in the clearing game. They finished 13-19, and those 6 failed clears felt like they all immediately led to goals. And what was crazy is I didn't think that Yale was doing anything special on the ride. It was a drop ride and it wasn't a ton of pressure. And so as a result, it felt like Penn just wasn't confident in their clearing game. I thought that I saw, you know, a long stick who had already, you know, either had a clearing pass or two with the ball 30 yards away from the midline and 3 Bulldogs between him and the midline, not knowing who he was going to throw the ball to. And it felt like that was the issue that among all the others was persistent for the Quakers. At the other end of the field, you know, so about a month ago, after the Princeton-Cornell game, my assessment of the 5 Ivy League teams that were in contention for Ivy League tournament spots, which are Yale, Cornell, Penn, Princeton, and Harvard, was that 2 of them were similar, Yale and Cornell, insofar as
Jake Taylor. Oh! Oh, look at me. And that starts with Notre Dame's defense, understanding that Duke's top line midfielders were too low so that they could get in the skip lanes. Duke was not doing a good job of spacing on offense that entire possession. That was a piss poor Duke possession from an X's and O's standpoint. They were too close together. They were treating it like a man up. Duke's defender says, oh, I'm going to get it to my guy. Kicks it right to Notre Dame. Jake Taylor is my favorite player. 1 dead body, 2 goals. I don't know what his official stat sheet is, because I missed a good chunk of the first half, but that should ultimately do it. Notre Dame is up 14-11 with 1 minute and 42 seconds right now. Hey guys, congrats on winning the national championship. Why don't you come back so that we can watch the brakes get beat off of this program, because Notre Dame is now Duke's daddy. Welcome back to campus, boys. Look how the mighty have fallen. Look at what you built and look at what we ransacked. I might call Deemer class after this and just try to fight him over the phone.
To finish the point I was making before, I feel like the 5 teams in the Ivy League that are vying for Ivy League tournament spots are Yale and Cornell, who share the fact that their overriding identity is athleticism and physicality. And then Penn, Princeton, and Harvard, who are athletic, but much more so slick and skilled offensively. Penn is different a little bit from Princeton and Harvard insofar as, you know, at least what we saw against Duke, they were very physical defensively and pretty athletic. And so as a result, like, you know, I was interested in how the Yale Penn game, well, and to an extent, and we saw this last week, the Penn Cornell games were going to manifest where that matchup, right? Not like for like. I was very confident that Cornell was going to beat Yale. That game was in Ithaca. Things, weird things happen when they play up there. And Cornell kind of has Yale's number. Meanwhile, you know, I'm pretty confident that Yale is going to perform nicely, as we already saw against Harvard, and then, you know, against Princeton at the end of the season. And so this was one where, you know, I picked Yale on the basis of everything that I just laid out. I thought that there was something a little bit more interesting about how Penn's defense was going to be able to match up with Yale offensively. But at the other end of the field, where, you know, Penn's attack is very small and their midfielders are pretty slick, pretty explosive, but not overpoweringly so, I felt like they didn't pressure Yale defensively. And it's one of the best performances we've seen from that unit all season, in so far as how comfortable they were throughout. And I attributed a fair amount of that to the reliance that Penn is offensively on ball movement, as opposed to beating their man and drawing slides. And so, you know, that's just something to file away as far as thinking about it in terms of how these matchups are going to manifest over the course of the rest of the month.
And Terry, I'm kind of looking at it here. Week 9 for the parlay hero. It looks like you went 4 for 5 again.
It's unbelievable. 4 weeks.
I'm choosing UMass over St. Joe's.
For the fourth week in a row, assuming that this Notre Dame result holds on, I will have gone 4-1. And just tell me how it makes sense from a betting standpoint to have gone 16-4 and had one guy ride your picks and end up going 0-4. Just absolutely outrageous.
Okay, there's 1 minute and 12 seconds left. Let's just see if I call Deemer class. Let's just see if he answers. And keep in mind, I tried to fight him at...
Hi, this is Deemer class, first class across. I can't get to your call right now. Please shoot me a text message or email me at deemer@firstclassbox.com. And I'll get back to you as soon as I can.
Hey, Deemer, it's your good friend Nick. I noticed a really, really cool segment in this Notre Dame-Duke game where they brought out a bunch of loser dorks at halftime who allegedly won the national championship. Big asterisk on that. Notre Dame's up too with a little bit of time to play. I just wanted to call and say that you stink. If I see you in the streets, it's hands on sight, just like it was in Vail in 2014. Notre Dame's the best. Duke sucks. Miss you. Hope all's well.
That's a really good voice.
That went well. Yeah, Duke did score, just made it a 2-goal game. We're not out of the woods yet. And the only thing that would make me worried about this 2-goal lead is if you were perfect right now and your parlay hinged on Notre Dame winning this game, but you already had the loss. So I just have all the confidence in the world. Although Duke just won the faceoff, 55 seconds left, which is an eternity. Oh, never mind. They were out of the box. I don't know the rules. Hey, coach, what is this line? Can I just step? Oh, nope, never mind. They're giving it back to Duke. God, hey, refs. Me. And Terry, you're ahead of me, so I just got that. Notre Dame just crossed midfield with the ball on their stick. Let's see if Duke can press out. They can. That was a hell of a check. Oh, my God. All right, here comes Duke. Cut through the middle of the field. Triple team, ball out of bounds. Hey, coach, look at me. I'm going to go score. Not on Notre Dame, baby. 30 seconds left, 2-goal game. I think this should about do it.
If there's one player on Notre Dame whose stick you want the ball in this situation, who is it?
Dobson.
Oh, that's
Dobson or Jake Taylor. People overthink that all the time. They're like, yeah, but what about Pat Kavanaugh? And I'm like, A, protect him because he hurt everything, kind of.
We're talking about ball in your own zone and you have to clear over the midline.
Dobson. Okay. Just, well, I guess Faison.
Yes, that's the right answer. I think, as he dances through an entire Duke player. Ride.
Yeah. Oh, and that should about do it. 16 seconds left. It's good that now we can do this again. And what's funny, I'll tell you this right now, is Notre Dame, big win on the road, 1-3. We're going to come away with a win. That locker room is going to be torn apart after the game. When Corrigan gets in one of those moods, he's not like, oh, okay, we won. good job, guys. He goes in and he's like, yeah, what were we doing? You guys take up, and just starts teeing off on us. And then a couple days later, it'll be like, hey, that was a great win. We got some things to work on. We got some stuff to do, but that was a great win, fellas. And I'm like, could have said that after the game and made the celebratory pint a little tastier, but is what it is. Only other thing as we wrap up, Terry, wasn't that a fun Cornell-Syracuse game?
I mean, we got to talk about Syracuse-Cornell. Obviously, game happened almost a week ago.
Week ago.
It was unbelievable. I mean, imagine a game with so much in it that you kind of forget an assistant coach got kicked out at the end of the first quarter when the game's over.
I mean, and this is one, after hosting Easter, my father, Steve, stayed, and we went and just got takeout pad thai from a nice spot. And I was like, yeah, there's a game on. I don't, you know, really care about it. And we started watching the game halfway through the fourth quarter after I saw the hullabaloo that was on Twitter. And by the end of that game that him and I didn't give a shit about, we truly didn't care. We were screaming at the TV. It was one of those, like, if you've never even watched a sport, if you didn't even know the rules, and if you've never even watched a screen, you would have been fired up watching that game. The back-to-back face-off, trading blows, great saves, great loose balls, great chaos. That was such a good game.
Well, to have a game-tying goal in the last minute, an apparent game-winning goal with 10 seconds left, and then this must have driven you crazy when Cornell didn't really even contest the face-off and allowed Syracuse to win
goal,
it back.
Goal! 10 seconds left. Make it a three-goal game. Score that and talk your shit. God, I love that. Sorry, go ahead.
When Cornell didn't really pressure up one, the faceoff with about 10 seconds to go and allowed Syracuse to win it back clean, and then Jake Stevens just runs down and scores with a second left, you must have been pulling what little hair out left you have left out of your head.
Honestly, no.
Really?
In those times, when I don't care about the game, I'm like, I need to see horrific defense and strategy to make this game go into overtime. And so when that happened, I was like, I could suspend it just because I wanted the stupidest and dumbest outcome, which was let's let this guy run right to the goal. And I was like, they did it. They did it. They let him run right to the goal. How stupid could you be? And my dad was yelling whatever out. He was just kind of repeating. He's like, he just let him run right there. And I'm like, I know, Dad. We're watching the same thing. it was a beautiful sports moment. It really was. And time expires. 15-12, never a doubt, absolute blowout victory, fifth straight win versus Duke, longest for either team. How you like them apples?
Ugh, what a note to end on. Nicky O, you've got a flight to catch. Thank you to our guests, Deemer Class, Steve Acello by proxy, and that'll do it for this edition of the Tailgate Podcast. If you liked what you heard, leave a rating and review. Tell a friend. Nick, we'll be back next week. I think we've got Duke, Virginia at 2:00 on Sunday. Are we going to be able to do another one in real time without the emotional investment?
I'd have to check because I'm calling the Las Vegas Desert Dogs hosting the Colorado Mammoth. So I'll be coming back from Vegas. Ooh. So if you thought I'm in rough shape now, you know. And live, we're recording with a dead body of Nick Ocello. Nick, how are you? Crickets. I'll check, if there's a chance that I can get out on the earliest flight and just kind of tune into that. I actually really like doing these. So
thank you as always. We'll be back later in the week with more Inside Lacrosse podcasts.
Love you, Terry.
Love you more.